Welcome back to Ordinary People, Extraordinary Things, the Revival Periods in the United States. We've come in our study up to what is my personal favorite revival, and I'll share more at the end why I think this is my favorite one out of all of them. It is called, in the literature that looks at this, the Great Revival. They've given up on things like the Great Awakening and the Second Great Awakening, and yet this time was so significant that they had to come up with some kind of term that had great in it. They could have just said revival, but no, there's something about this that is a great revival. And I hope you catch the flavor of it. It's a very short-lived revival, but in some respects, an incredibly unique one in the history of the United States. Began in New York City. This is a picture on a postcard from 1857. This is what New York City had become by that time. Now, when you look at that picture, you've got to realize how much it had changed since the late 1600s, 1700s, when it was settled. Most of this area had been houses, and there was a small kind of political area, the community buildings, down toward the harbor. But now, businesses had taken over much of what had been houses. And then, to handle all the immigration, tenements had been built. And all of the evils that Thomas Jefferson saw in the city existed in New York City. And yet, this became the seed place for the beginning of what was called the Great Revival. Now, it did that partly because of all of the pain of living in a city. You've got an immigration population that is separated from its roots in Europe. You've got people who are wondering. You've got the financial collapse that has happened. In New York City, about 30,000 people lost their jobs in the financial collapse of that time. Now, that was a huge percentage of the whole city. And so you've got just kind of this maelstrom going on in the city of dissatisfaction, of unhappiness, of the crime, the filth that a city produces. Now, what also happened as people moved out of the city, so the inhabitants who owned the houses that used to be there, moved out. They began to move out of the city in rapid numbers, and the churches went with them. The Brooklyn Tabernacle, you know, built for the ministry of Charles Finney, had moved out to follow its people out toward not yet suburbs. That didn't really happen until after World War II, but out further in the city. The old Brick Presbyterian Church, another of the well-known churches, followed its people out, moving further out. And so within the center of the city, where all the tenements and businesses are, there are fewer and fewer churches to serve a burgeoning kind of population. Now, churches are leaving. One church decided to stay. Now, we don't know exactly the history of why, but it was the North Dutch Church at the corner of Williams and Fulton Streets. Now, the North Dutch Church, it is speculated, waited too long to move until it wasn't feasible anymore. So its members had begun moving out further to the further edges of the city, and the church just kind of hung in there as the attendance began to go down and then financially began to go down. And all of a sudden they wake up one day and they say, wow, we can't continue here. We can't afford to do ministry here anymore. And so that kind of drove them to try some different things. Now, just again, the note to today in the United States and in Europe, in the United States there's been this history of churches moving out of the city, and you may have seen that. I once had a call to a church right near Chicago, but it was on one of the outward rings. In my denomination, you can trace the growth of Chicago by looking at where the churches got planted. So the first churches were right near the center of the city, and then the population moves out to the suburbs, and then there's another wave, and we can count churches down there. And I had a call to Anderson, Illinois, which was Anderson, Indiana, which was way down on the south, the latest of the waves going out of the city. And as a result, we really, in my denomination, are just trying now to try to learn how to reach the city. Because very, very often the cities are left behind as the churches move out to the suburbs following its people. And yet there are some very, very courageous people who decide to stay and find unique ways to reach the city. Well, if you know of, have in your denomination, churches that have decided to do that, their mother is the North Dutch Church. Now imagine, you've got all these immigrants, a lot of Lutherans, Roman Catholics, they're from all over Europe, so they don't necessarily speak the Dutch language, the Netherlands being one of the smaller churches there, and you've got in your name the North Dutch Church. There aren't a whole lot of folks who are going to say, oh, that's my kind of people who go there and go start attending. And so they had all kinds of strikes against them, this declining population. But what they decided to do was hire an evangelist, somebody who could hopefully turn the trend around, begin to reach people and bring them into this church building again and bring it back to its former glory. And the person they hired was a man named Jeremiah Lanfear. Actually, this is a statue of him, a bronze statue of him on a bench in New York that you can go and sit next to him. And I have not yet done that in my life. If I ever get to New York again in this life, that's one of the things I'm looking to see, is to sit next to Jeremiah Lanfear. Don't know much about him. We know he was born in 1809 in Coxsackie, New York. We know he went into business. In fact, it was probably the mercantile business. So he was a businessman. In other words, he's not somebody who's been to seminary. He's not somebody who's gone to Bible college. He's not somebody who was known as a leader in a church anywhere before this. But somehow, for some reason, he decided to leave his work as a businessman and go into the church. We do know that he's hired to do this job. And 1842, he's in New York preparing, not preparing for this job necessarily, but being prepared by God for this job. There's a description of him that is said he was tall, with a pleasant face, an affectionate manner, an indomitable energy and perseverance, a good singer, gifted in prayer and exhortation, a welcome guest to any house, shrewd and endowed with much tact and common sense. Not a bad kind of description, right? So he takes on this job, begins in 1857 as the evangelist of the North Dutch Church. Now what do you do? You're going to try to turn around things for the North Dutch Church. He approached his job as probably any good businessman would. He divided the whole area into certain districts, and he simply began calling from house to house to house. He had prepared a packet of information about the church that he would leave with various houses, but he talked with everyone from district after district after district according to his carefully laid out plan, and inviting them to come to church. Did that. Each Sunday he had reserved an area of pews in the church ready for all those visitors, and people didn't come. He decided that he had to change his tactics. So he began visiting the motels and the boarding houses, and he began leaving cards with the times of the church services, saying, tell people that if they're looking for a church to go to come to the North Dutch Church. And again, he would sit there on Sunday morning, and people did not come. After doing this for some time, with no real visible results, he was indeed frustrated. In fact, didn't know what in the world to do. And so he decided to pray. Now you'll notice, I began talking about the second great awakening, that people, that using that quote that said that there was nothing else they could do. They had no power, no political power, no capability to get things done in a way that would change that community. So all they had left was prayer. Well, that's where Jeremiah Lanfear was. He had tried everything he knew how to do. He had come to the end. Nothing had worked, so he decided to pray. But he thought he would invite other people to pray with him. And so he sent out into the neighborhood, giving it to various businessmen, what was called a bill, again, just something inviting to pray. And this is what it said. Started with the state question, how often shall I pray? And the answer, as often as the language of prayer is in my heart, as often as I see my need of help, As often as I feel the power of temptation, as often as I am made sensible to any spiritual declension or feel the aggression of a worldly spirit. In prayer, we leave the business of time for that of eternity and intercourse with men for the intercourse with God. So he set a time. Come and pray. Come join in this intercourse with God. The day he set aside was noon, Wednesday, September 23. And when I try to picture what was going on in Jeremiah Lamphere, he never wrote about it, so we don't know. But I try to picture that this was kind of the last-ditch effort. There's nothing else to do. And I imagine he was probably pretty cynical at this point. I remember early in ministry, in a first church I served as pastor, thinking the same kind of thoughts of, I've tried everything, and nothing is growing this church. And the kind of despair as you see people leaving, and as you see what happens in churches, sometimes between people, and all kinds of forces that exist inside the church and outside the church that will try to bring it to destruction. And you try, and you try, and you try, and nothing happens. Nothing happens. And I imagine as he handed out these invitations to prayer to various businessmen, people in the neighborhood of the North Dutch church, that he probably thought, well, this is it. Noontime came around. Nobody was there except Jeremiah Lamphere sitting in the council room, which was in the back of the church. 12:15, no one there. At that point, I picture him getting up and checking and seeing if the door was locked or stuck. Or maybe nobody could find it, since the consistory room where the meeting was announced to be was in the back of the church and you had to go upstairs to get it. I imagine him walking down, looking around. Is anybody here? Nobody there. Finally, at 12:30, he heard some sound on the steps. And over the next few minutes, six people gathered to pray. Now, they had a good time doing that, and they felt like they were at least doing something, looking at the spiritual nature of the city of New York. So they decided to meet the next Wednesday once again, and that before they came, they would invite their friends. And so the next week, there were 20 people there. And then the next week, there were 30 people there. And it was sometime during that meeting that they decided to not meet every week anymore, that they were going to meet every day at noon for prayer. And what happened from there is rather unbelievable. September 23, it began. By January 1858, they were in three large lecture halls of the church. That's how many people there were gathering in these large lecture halls. The program was simple. They'd sing a hymn. They would pray or be led in prayer. That's all. And other people began to hear now about what was going on at the North Dutch church. And so they decided that they would start praying as well. And by March 1858, it was estimated by newspaper men who were going from place to place counting how many people were in each building that there were 10,000 people meeting daily for prayer in the city of New York in 20 different locations. And one of the unique things about this revival is that the press was engaged with it and excited about it, and they were, in fact, announcing it. Here's an article by one man in the newspaper. It says, "We understand that arrangements are being made for the establishment of one or two additional meetings in the upper portion of the city. Soon the striking of the five bells at 12 o'clock will generally be known as the signal for the hour of prayer." Can you imagine that? Now, I live in a fairly small town in the state of Michigan in the United States, and I could probably see in our local paper getting some kind of announcement like that going. But it was unusual that this was happening in all the newspapers. Reporters were going from place to place and reporting on what was happening. Some of the well-known preachers of the day were getting involved, and they were giving some talks or sermons at these meetings. But mostly it was just people gathering together, singing a hymn or two, and then gathering together for prayer. This thing spread like wildfire. You know, people in New York were doing this, but it began to spread beyond there. The interesting thing about the Great Revival is we know it started there, but we also know that God was doing something else in Pittsburgh that was another spark that eventually the two flames or the two fires joined together. In Pittsburgh, I forgot one thing. at the end of this period, there was a man who wrote this. He said, "I am from Omaha, Nebraska. On my journey east, I have found a continuous prayer meeting all the way. We call it 2,000 miles from Omaha to Boston, and here was a prayer meeting about 2,000 miles in extent." That's how rapidly this thing spread. But anyway, on to Pittsburgh. In the fall of 1857, there was a group of people that became concerned there. Now, they didn't know all of what was happening in New York, as far as we can tell. And yet, God was calling them to do two things. One, a group of churches, a multi-interdenominational churches, decided that they would dedicate the first Sunday in January to pray for revival, and the next Sunday to prayer and fasting for revival. And so that was another way that God was doing something that eventually just swept the nation. Now, when we look at the Great Revival, we find that there were three phases to it. Prayer meeting attendance was one of them, a very important one of them. There were all of these meetings going on all over the place. I can't quite picture this quite well. You know, imagine this happening daily in every major city from Omaha to Boston. Omaha at that point was at the fringe of the country, the frontier. And yet in every major city, in dozens of places, there are these prayer meetings going on. I know how difficult it is. We have in our country a national day of prayer. And we have in my community 42 churches. And we gather for noon in a prayer in about three different places, and then sometimes for an evening meeting. And at most, we see at a gathering 20, 25, 30 people. And I imagine, what would that be like to see people doing this every day? Thousands upon thousands of them taking their breaks, businesses closing, all because they want to pray. They want to pray. That's something of what the Holy Spirit does. Now, something happens then to the churches as well. In these 2 years, it's estimated that 2 million people were added to church rolls as a result of the prayer or the Great Revival, sometimes referred to as the prayer revival. In 1859, it went international. A man was visiting from Ireland, and he saw it was going back, went back to Ireland and started it, and same thing happened there. And then somebody was visiting Ireland from England and brought that revival to England, and then somebody from there brought it to Europe, and it extended as far as India. So in a number of years, there was this incredible kind of renewal of faith, revival of religious fervor. And it all started because of Jeremiah Lanfear. So the three phases, the first one was the prayer meeting attendance. The second phase, I'm going to talk about more next time, and that is the conversion of Dwight Lyman Moody. Don't want to say too much about him, but he was a shoe salesman who was converted and took part in this revival and became the major figure of the next section of revival in the United States. And so he's a very, very important person. And we're going to leave off the next lecture and dedicate that entirely to looking at Dwight Lyman Moody and the heritage that he gave to revivals, and not just his own period of time, but after the Civil War, even to today. A third kind of phase was a missionary movement. A young men's Christian association found its heyday in this revival. The Salvation Army established during this period of revival. And those who look at history say there were 849 missionary societies that were begun as a result of this revival of a couple of years. Wow. Like I say, this is one of the most exciting revivals for me, partly because it just came from God. There is no other explanation for what happened. What were the results? Well, there were several. There were renewed social concern, I guess is the way to put it, as a result of this revival. In fact, one person put it this way: the rapid growth of concern with purely social issues, such as poverty, working men's rights, the liquor traffic, slum housing, and racial bitterness is the chief feature distinguishing American religion after 1865 from that of the first half of the 19th century. And that's largely due to this revival. Now, think of some of the issues. We talked about poverty, that these immigrants are coming and they're poor. There were no working men's rights. Children were being abused in work. Liquor traffic, the problems with alcoholism were huge. Slum housing, occasionally in our day, in our country, we get to hear about some slumlord who's just putting people up in very substandard housing, and they're dealing with rats, and they're dealing with all kinds of a variety of insects, and et cetera. And that person has to clean his act up because we have laws. Well, those laws all came out of this revival. Our racial bitterness. This is the time prior to the Civil War in the United States. And so there's a great mistrust of people from other color. And certainly as immigrants came, people from other background. And so there was this great social concern that began to bubble up and found its way in the expression of missionary societies and social agencies. Lay ministry was a big part of this. Jeremiah Lanphier was not ordained, and you don't find anybody in this whole movement aside from Henry Ward Beecher in New York as a name that somebody was involved with these noon prayer meetings. There were no big names. Jeremiah Lanphier did not become a big name. Nobody came to check with Jeremiah Lanphier about what they should be doing. It was all one person taking it somewhere else, who took it somewhere else, who took it somewhere else, and it was totally a lay-driven ministry. In addition to that, again, women became involved very deeply. At first, it was only men meeting at noon, but soon the women came, and they were soon leading singing. And once again, that opening up of roles to women. People realized, I guess, especially as a result of this great revival or prayer revival, that you could be an ordinary person, and God could do extraordinary things through you. That's why this is one of my favorites, just because there's nobody here that got a big name as a result of this revival. Nobody that was seen as the driving force. Nobody that you could point back to and say, it was him. And certainly Jeremiah Lanphier wouldn't say that it was him because he didn't know what he was doing and didn't know what he had done after he had done it. He just realized he had been watching the Holy Spirit do something very, very special. And so this is the incredible great revival, one of the greatest in the history of the United States, and one of the most unique, beginning in the city, driven by lay people, so much so that a place like the North Dutch Church can begin to cross ethnic barriers and grow. And so next time we're going to look at Dwight Moody, because he came out of this time, out of this revival. He didn't become well known until after the Civil War and after this revival had begun to wane. But we're going to look at his ministry because he becomes, again, one of those incredibly ordinary people. In fact, if you had tried to list somebody who would be a person who would become one of the great revivalists in history, no one, I think, when he was a young man, would point to Dwight L. Moody. And so next time, we're going to look at Moody.